Howard Mansfield is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, you were talking about AirSats. Why were you doing that?
Well, it comes up in the context of these large corporations pretending to be
warm and cuddly.
Warm and cuddly, you know. The instant restaurants are, have just become
Happy Meals.
But the instant decor that is a period piece that is established. You don't see much of it, but the basic idea is you establish an English pub in a strip mall.
Mm-hmm. And or the 1960s or the 1950s or the backwoods junk store.
Yeah. And then, or Hollywood, or any one of a thousand different.
It's prefab; it's all brand new.
hence AirSats, and it seems that's part of this,
which is translated as fake.
But the other side of that, and it's what I think is, you get to talk soon here, Howard. maybe not. We're working on that. But the other side of that, of course, is the authenticity, and what I think everybody's trying to do is create this aura of authenticity, because this is this latent sense. God help us, that authenticity sells.
And you do, in all of your books, you really are looking at that which is authentic, aren't you?
Yeah, you're trying to figure out, well, what is real? And what I talk about in this book is sticks and stones. Because for millennia, for the longest time before up until just now, all there was were trees, rocks, the few people you knew, the animals around you, the sky by day and night, and that was what your world by day and by night in dreams. And those things, sticks and stones, they were holy. They were sacred sites. And just as we think today trees are living, of course, many, many cultures regard bones, stones, as the bones of the earth, stones being animate, stones being alive. And that ancient belief, I think, is inside just about everybody, and you see it in the response that people have all the time to various trees, to various sites that they decide is their landmark, their home place, the Axis Mundi, the center of their world, where they organize their world from. You see it in many specific examples.
You take us visiting bridges, stone bridges, and give us a sense in the bones of the earth. And that was the one that really kind of locked for me, to go visit the bones of the earth. Let's see.
Those bridges, these are bridges they built in the middle of the 19th century out of stone without mortar. They're essentially in Hillsborough, New Hampshire. And you can go see them. Five or six of them are still carrying traffic today. They withstood tremendous floods and little earthquakes that actually happened in New Hampshire and things like that. And they were built the way they were built. The Romans would have built them. You throw up a scaffold and you build the arch. You take it away, the arch should stand, if you know what you're doing. And the strange thing about them is they have this presence that they seem to be almost medieval, which obviously they can't be in New Hampshire. They have, as the fellow I was with said, they seem like something a gang of trolls would live under. They have this real presence and this real weight to them. And they were built by people who really had a feeling for stone, who essentially fed themselves with granite by either quarrying it or having to move it to farm, or making later in the 19th century an attraction of the old man of the mountain so tourists would come up and pay to see it. But New Hampshire fed itself with granite, and granite is a real part of that landscape, and people really have an intimate relationship with it.
Part of that feels like, trying to generalize, a desire to connect with nature, having been divorced from it pretty seriously in the last, at least in this country, 40, 50 years. With the intercession of television and the roads and the strip malls that tend to block the natural away from us, and even the materials, which goes to the stone bridges. We build bridges for interstates, but they're cement bridges.
Or steel.
Well, some combination. And somehow or other, that it would seem that part of the appeal is not just the authenticity and the old, or even the medieval, that it is that lack of disconnect, which is to say the connection.
Yeah, we have this, we being people have this intimate connection with stone, in that we look to stone to be eternal. And it's why one of the reasons why the cathedral builders chose stone, it was seen as having this connection between the soul and the eternal things. So there's that feeling that stone is like outside of us, beyond us, it's going to be eternal. And actually, where we get tripped up is that everything, of course, is changing, and stone is just another ticking clock. It's just moving a lot slower than our own particular biological clock. But everything is running back to the sea. Everything is crumbling. So that's that contradiction right there.
And you talk about whether or not one thinks of them as sentient rocks, that they are always going to molecular level.
They're always falling. There's a great geologist, Robert Thorsen. He talks about, he's just crazy about stone walls. He grew up someplace where there weren't, I forget. But he remembers he put his hand on them at night, and all of a sudden he could feel like the stone wall shift. And he said, oh my God. This wall has been in place for hundreds of years, and these stones have been together for, you know, ever. And he just felt a little bit of the stone give way just then. And that's what's going on. What happened in a great example is the old man of the mountain. It's like the logo of New Hampshire. It's in the 19th century. Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote the story about the great stone face. People were just crazy about it. Crazy about it. It's like a bunch of stone on the side of Franconia Notch up in the White Mountains. A beautiful spot. And my God, in May of 2003, it just fell off. People were just upset. There were thousands of letters to the newspapers in the state saying, that's my life that fell. I mean, I said hello to the old man the first thing in the summer. I said goodbye to him. I grew up with the old man. Put him back. Well, you can't. It's not like the Eiffel Tower fell over. No one built the old man, even though for years he had been held together with cables and epoxy. But it just shows you that, again, that real lithic allegiance that lives in otherwise people who are very straightforward, but all of a sudden a few hundred tons of stone falls off the side of a mountain and people are really radically upset.
There's another thing you say about stone and people, that we're all made of the same elements. That we are all...
Stones build bones, yeah.
And that we forget that for all that, you know, sometimes there's a passing phrase at a funeral, from dust to dust, but we forget that we are all made of the same elements.
Yes. That's.
And as you speak about the bones of the earth, in a variety of different ways, you connect us back as if this were news.
Well, the simple things end up being news, don't they?
Well, you are a reporter. You're an elegant writer, and fundamentally, you're a reporter.
Well, I go around and talk to people. People ask you, what do you do? I'm curious about something. I'll go talk to people. That's about it.
We talked recently to Joseph Ellis on the subject of Washington and George Washington, yes, His Excellency.
That was the name of his book about George Washington, right, who was occasionally called His Excellency.
And it calls to mind the story you tell about Harvard Square, which, you know, and the combination, the juxtaposition, contraposition in some ways, of a narrative of Washington's life and the saga of this tree that lived at Harvard Square.
Yeah, this is actually a great story, and it really gets to how people relate to the land and the stories we tell ourselves. The Washington Elm stood on the Cambridge Common in 1775 when Washington came to take command of the Continental Army at a very low point in the Revolution. Things were looking bad. Well, about 60 years after all the events, this story arose that Washington took command of the troops under this elm tree.
This particular elm
tree.
That
exact elm tree, which was a beautiful elm tree, but one of a, you know, not particularly spectacular elm tree. And all of a sudden, a lot of octogenarians and people stood up at these July 4th banquets you used to have, and all of a sudden they had this sudden memory of it. And the story grew and grew, and a falsified diary was published, and pretty soon Washington was taking command of thousands of troops in beautiful uniforms, and people were parading and flags, and it was phenomenal. It was just the greatest start to a country that had ever been. And it didn't happen. Washington rode into town by himself. It was raining. Boston was under siege. No one was around. Washington was feeling a little sick. He probably, maybe, sort of could have ridden past this one tree because it was near a crossroads at the time. But this tree became the object of veneration to worship Washington, essentially. The Washington Elm and Washington became one. This tree, Longfellow wrote poems about it. They would have ceremonies. People all across the country would have pilgrimage to go to this tree. They would bring home parts to the point that to this day, the Cambridge Historical Commission's number one question is, people call up and say, I have a piece of the Washington Elm. what's it worth? The tree eventually fell in 1920 when some poor workmen were trying to prop it up, and it fell over, and they felt terrible about it.
It died.
It died. It was dead, and it had been in the middle of the street by that point. The Cambridge, you know, the Cambridge Common had moved. But the important part of this story isn't that Washington didn't really take command of it. The important part is that they believe that, and in that belief, they were closer to the truth about Washington than we are today, or we can be with most of our biographies. They were right, wrong about the facts, but right about the truth. So that Washington, who was the axis mundi of the American Revolution, and this tree was the axis mundi of their belief in that, and the two merged together, and so they made a poetic approach to the truth.
Say what that word, those words means, axis mundi.
Yeah, I should say that. Axis mundi would be, it's an old term for the center of the earth. In pre-Christian Europe, many villages would be gathered around a central pole, a Roland, or a sacred tree. That was the center of the earth. That was the center of your known world. That was the landmark from which everything was measured. And one of the things that people feel sort of disquieted today is, well, we don't really have an axis mundi. We don't really have a center. We have a time of many centers in many places. But where's the central landmark? And that's one of the things I talk about in the book.
That's a physical landmark.
Physical landmark, a sacred rock, a sacred tree, a sacred place, a church. It could be in any number of things.
This Washington story, and more generally what you're talking about, is just magnificently pagan.
Oh, exactly. It's tree worship. I mean, when you see this, there's this old photo of the Washington Elm, and it's got banners and flags and everything. I think it's at one of the centennial celebrations. And they've dressed the tree up to make it even more grand. And the words that recur over and over in all the stories, and then D.A.R. stories and all the tour guide stories, sacred, hallowed, witness, if this tree could talk. And further, it gets even a little more conflated. They believe that this elm was a remnant of the so-called forest primeval. So that, my God, it was nature blessing this new nation. And it turned out, even as a lot of people tried to point out at the time, no, this was part of seven elms that were planted on the common to shade cows. So,
well, and the pagan part is to me interesting, because apparently Jefferson took it into his head that there was a purity in the old Anglo-Saxon, going back into the heart of ancient Europe, and there's a sort of druidic quality to it, but that the purity of the revolution, of which Washington was the defining symbol, at least for a long time, again, there's this sort of sense of, and Jefferson argued, was an argument from natural law. So there's this strange, and in some ways very appealing, connectedness to the deep past, to nature, to natural law, which in the Enlightenment environment was very important. And yet all this is occurring in this nation that pleads reason.
Exactly.
pleads an active intervention, at least a lot of people would argue, a lot of active intervention on the part of gods. So there's in some ways a delicious contradiction sort of built into this.
It's like an outbreak almost of the old-time affection for the land, you know, which Christianity was very much about rooting out. You know, there's all sorts of accounts of them destroying sacred groves in Lithuania and people worshiping these little rock shrines and going in there and taking that apart.
And when you talk about the trolls under the bridge, that was out too.
Yeah, trolls, that kind of stuff was out. The Dark Ages were out.
This is Howard Mansfield. I'm going to interrupt so that we can come back in a moment with more of the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I and Howard Mansfield invite you to be with us when we return.